This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMPD releases all of their dash and body cam footage in the Keith Scott shooting case, and we hear from Police Chief Kerputney about that video. The investigation is calling for an independent evaluation of how CMPD conducts itself and his own reaction to criticism. First Lady Michelle Obama stumps for Hillary Clinton in Charlotte and elsewhere in the state this week, what she had to say, and specifically how she folded Charlotte into her remarks. The Charlotte Chamber holds their annual retreat and gets an earful on what needs to be done if the city wants to avoid another series of demonstrations like the ones that made national news after the Scott shooting. The governor states the obvious, that Charlotte and the legislature have to have some making up to do, and the coast prepares for Hurricane Matthew. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by WFAE's David Borax, Nick Oxner from WBTV News.
Good morning.
Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Morning to both of you.
Morning.
You can reach us through email or at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. But we're beginning this morning with an update on what Hurricane Matthew is up to and where he's headed. For that, we turn to Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV NBC Charlotte. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm great. Where is Hurricane Matthew right now?
Well, Matthew right now is about 50 miles off the coast of Daytona Beach, Florida. It passed just offshore of the Kennedy Space Center, where they recorded a wind gust of 107 miles per hour out on the Cape, with sustained winds of 77 miles per hour. But the central pressure is still pretty low for this storm. But the winds have actually gone down a little bit in the eye. I mean, we say a little bit. It's still a Cat 3 with winds of 120 miles per hour. The good news so far for Florida, while it's been bad on the immediate coast, it hasn't made that turn left and made a landfall. It's actually paralleling the coast by about 40 or 50 miles offshore. And because of the way Florida's shaped, as you get up towards Jacksonville, the coast kind of goes back to the west a little bit. As long as it continues to move almost due north-northwest, it actually should be a little bit further offshore as it gets closer to Jacksonville.
So this sounds like it's not turning out to be the storm that we thought it might be. What's the most powerful wind that land has experienced in Florida?
Probably that out at the Cape with that 107 mile per hour gust.
So that's less than 140 miles per hour, which was what they're talking about yesterday. So that's more like Hugo when it came to Charlotte with 80 mile per hour sustained wind.
Exactly. Now that's still going to cause some issues on the immediate coast. Most of the gusts have been around 60, 70, 80 miles an hour with sustained around 60. It's still going to knock down some trees and do some damage. The big story with this storm is going to be the water. We're still really concerned about storm surge in the Jacksonville area because obviously you got the river. It comes right into downtown Jacksonville. And because ahead of the storm, the wind's coming out of the east, it's pushing water into the mouth of the river. And it basically creates what we get in eastern North Carolina, sometimes called backwater flooding, where the mouth of the river gets dammed up by the storm surge. And the water coming down the river from the rainfall inland can't get out to the ocean. So it starts flooding over the banks of the rivers, and you end up getting flooding. So there's still a big concern for that, and even all the way up to Charleston, because as the storm winds down, it's already pushed that surge of water north, and kind of like the momentum is built up. If you had a plow and you were pushing water or dirt, sometimes if you stop the plow, that dirt and water is going to continue to push forward and will still get up into the South Carolina coast.
Let's talk about South Carolina and North Carolina because we have people listening to us who have interests there, property there, et cetera. We're talking about the hurricane brushing at least the South Carolina coast sometime early Saturday morning, correct?
Yeah, Saturday morning into early Saturday afternoon, it's going to pass about 80 miles off the coast of Charleston. So areas like Hilton Head all the way up to Charleston will see probably a 3 to 5 foot storm surge. And that's lower than Florida, but South Carolina low country is more susceptible to storm surge. 3 to 5 feet of water in Charleston is going to cause a lot of flooding in those typical low-lying areas. The city floods pretty much on an average astronomical high tide. So it's going to take very little to get some flooding into the Charleston area. And that really is going to be the big concern in the South Carolina low countries. It makes that near pass.
The storms like this put meteorologists and politicians in an awkward position because there's no way to really predict exactly what path or how powerful a storm will be when it approaches land where it approaches it. So did Governor Nikki Haley jump the gun, do you think, in evacuating South Carolina and reversing both lanes of I-26 on Wednesday, I think it was, to get people out of the coastal areas, or did she do the right thing?
I think she did the right thing because this is one of those situations where you got to err on the side of caution. And because it takes so long to get that many people out of that area, you have to evacuate way ahead of time. When I lived in southeast Louisiana, this is one of the dilemmas that the New Orleans area faced. It took 3 whole days to evacuate everybody out of southeast Louisiana. The problem is a 3-day forecast for a hurricane is inherently not super precise. So you have to take that chance sometimes that you're going to over-evacuate for these storms just because it's the time and the infrastructure and the needs that it takes to evacuate that many people. And because the Lowcountry is so susceptible to flooding and storm surge, I think that it was the right call to go ahead and do it ahead of time. I think the thing that's interesting about these situations is sometimes you basically have to over-prepare for the storm, and you hear this a lot. You know, you prepare for the worst and hope for the best.
Right. So in the final analysis, what do you anticipate for much of South Carolina and North Carolina as this storm approaches us, hits us, goes back out to sea?
The big story for North Carolina, and I think for most of South Carolina, is probably going to end up being flooding rains, because even as the storm turns away and the strongest winds, and for North Carolina, the worst storm surge stays to the south, we're still going to see tons of rain. And probably a story that's been kind of under the radar is how wet it's been in eastern North Carolina. The remnants of Julia flooded several counties in northeastern North Carolina. All the rivers and all the soil in the eastern part of the state is saturated. So this water falling on the grounds in eastern North Carolina are going to end up causing quite a bit of what we call freshwater flooding from the rainfall. And I think that's going to be the calling card from this system. And even into the Charlotte area, we could see 1 to as much as 3 inches of rain. Now, we need it because if we're behind, we can take that a little bit better, but we could even see some flash flooding, especially the further east you get from Charlotte.
And, Brad, you have some good news this morning because longtime broadcaster here in Charlotte, Larry Sprinkle, who has been off your air for quite some time now due to an automobile accident, is back this morning. He's been in broadcasting here for, well, since Marconi, I think.
It seems like forever. It's like, you know, between radio and TV, it's definitely over 30 years. So it's amazing. Yeah, he's been kind of doing the noon show here and there and working his way back. I was talking with him, and he's great. He's really come back fully. He was a little slow at first. He wasn't getting around super fast. But he had to kind of relearn everything because he'd been away so long. He had to relearn the process.
All the technology's changed.
It has. We actually had all new robotic cameras in our studio, which was completely new. So that was something. And so today was his first full morning show back. And it's kind of funny because I actually needed him. We had another meteorologist on vacation. And with the storm, I said, Larry, I need you to work. He said, sure thing. And that's just Larry Sprinkle. He's one of the hardest working guys I've ever ran into.
Well, give him our best and congratulations to him on being back and being fully recovered. Brad Panovich, the chief meteorologist at WCNC NBC Charlotte. Thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. Have a great day.
You too. David Borax is here from WFAE News along with Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Was very pleased that Brad was with us this morning. Sean Flynn, the managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Let's talk about what happened on Tuesday night when Charlotte-Mecklenburg police released all of the dash and body cam video from the Keith Scott shooting. Why did they decide to do that finally on Tuesday night?
Because a group of media, including WFAE and WBTV and the Charlotte Observer, basically pushed for them to and all but threatened to sue them if they didn't release the video. Quite frankly, I don't believe that the chief would have released this video had there not been pressure for them to do so.
And because the community was asking for it, and the family of Keith Scott also was asking for it. Nick, you're shaking your head. It's part of it, but
it's not
the only reason.
No, I agree. I agree. The family, they released it. The answer you're probably looking for is they released the video after the family viewed
I'm looking for the truth.
Aren't we all, Mike? They released the video after the family viewed it, and police said that they wouldn't release it until the family had an opportunity to view it. That was just the latest in a string of excuses why they hadn't released it before.
Right, and the family did request that Friday afternoon, and they granted CMPD did say they would go ahead and do it to go ahead and beat that new North Carolina law.
And there are literally hours of video from the dash cam and the body cam. So what have we learned from looking at this video? Have any of you seen most of it?
Yes.
Okay. So what have we learned that we didn't know before they released it?
I think the community really wanted to see how police were reacting and interacted. There was some concern about Mr. Scott being handcuffed immediately following it. Of course, police say that's part of their protocol because even after somebody's shot, they've seen instances where the person can stand right back up and become combative. They wanted to see how police officers reacted. I think, unfortunately, and fortunately, I think transparency is a great thing, and I welcome it. Really glad that they did release him, but there are some things that I don't know if we all need to see. And I felt like I had to watch it, and I didn't really want to watch it.
You mean the death,
and
the actual.
Yes, because you're watching a man die,
right? Yeah.
And it wasn't very pleasant.
And it also left a lot of questions still unanswered.
Absolutely.
The lawyers for the family are saying that it still doesn't answer the question of whether or not the gun that was recovered from the scene was in his ankle holster at the time, or was it out? The video doesn't show that.
Yeah.
It doesn't answer why he was, you know, one of the bullets hit him in the back, and how that would relate to him presenting a threat, an imminent threat to officers if he's being, you know, if the bullet's entering from the back.
And David Borax, you actually spoke with Chief Putney about the gun and the fact that the video doesn't show a lot about the gun, and you asked him this question. Go ahead.
So we now have all the video from the scene, and there's no gun. Where is the gun?
Well, that is the whole point of the investigative process. The district attorney will talk about all those facts and all those factors, and that decision will be made. It's going to be in his hands, hopefully, in the next couple of weeks.
Was that an answer?
That was a non-answer. That was the chief saying, you know, we still don't, we're not going to tell you all the information that we have. And, you know, just to follow up on your question, we still don't know where the gun was at the scene, as Eric just explained.
Because the still photograph shows the gun on the ground, that one still, but you can't see it in the video. You can't see it whether it's in his hands or not. You don't see it on the ground
right.
in the video.
And that's why I think it was important. No one wants to watch the gruesome video and see a man take his last breath. But if this video is the only thing that we have of possibly answering that question, I think that was why it was important to release the video, as gruesome as it may be. And I think the fact that it didn't answer any didn't really answer many questions, it speaks just as much as if it had answered questions.
Yeah, and while the video did not show the gun at all, twice you heard an officer saying, hey, go get over there by the gun. So they did reference the gun two times in that video,
and,
at least
and evidently
audibly.
Two officers exchanged places, standing in a certain position for a significant amount of time. Are they standing on the gun? Is that what police are alleging?
We don't know. That's
what you would think, but yeah, we don't know.
Okay. A lot more to talk about with regard to the video being released and about this gun and about conspiracy theories that have cropped up, one of which came up during our public conversation here on WFAE on Tuesday night. I want to talk about that because you addressed that, I believe, with the chief, David Borax. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks Weekly or Local News Roundup here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Spruce Pine Potters Market, featuring over 30 regional potters and clay artists tomorrow and Sunday at the historic Cross Street Building, Spruce Pine, North Carolina. Details at sprucepinepottersmarket.com. An urgent vet pet clinic providing veterinary urgent care 365 days a year. Your pet can't wait to feel better. More info at urgentvet.com. Two down, one to go. At least that will be the way it is in terms of presidential debates by Monday morning. On Sunday night, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump meet in the second of two debates following the first debate, which set record ratings. Clinton rose in the polls, so what will happen as a result of the town hall-style meeting in which half of the questions will come from members of the audience, undecided voters? We'll talk about that on this program Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Fallout from the only vice presidential debate of the campaign. Congressional Republicans weigh the down-ballot Trump effect. And the FBI arrests another NSA contractor.
The News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. On listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks. David Borax from WFAE News is here along with Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV, Sean Flynn, managing editor of Time Warner Cable News, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer of for the Charlotte Observer. There have been a number of conspiracy theories that have sprung up around that gun and its presence on the scene. There are conspiracy theories. We're talking about the Keith Scott case here now. Conspiracy theories about a white officer actually having shot Mr. Smith and then being replaced by an African-American officer. Some say there are no African-American officers in that video. And there is a conspiracy theory that was brought up during our public conversation here on WFAE on Tuesday night about the civilian-on-civilian shooting that occurred uptown on that Wednesday night of protests. And, David, you asked Chief Putney if any video of the incident involving that civilian, Justin Carr, existed.
That's still under investigation. There was obviously some footage that we saw from it, and we're reviewing that as part of that investigative process. I wish we could release more information, but because it's a current investigation and a suspect is involved, we really are prohibited from doing that because it would adversely affect the judicial process. But I'm not into conspiracies. I'm into facts, and that's what we did, a fact-finding, and obviously facts led us to a suspect that was arrested.
And are there any plans to release that?
I think like any other evidence, it would be after the process is totally complete. That is different from dash cam. I'm not the custodian, quote unquote, as it relates to a body worn as it is with video that was from other sources. Okay. So that is specific to the investigation that can't be released currently.
Now, obviously, the initial absence of video and because of the viral nature of today's world and the fact that the video raises more questions than perhaps it answers, you get these conspiracy theories going around. What does that say about releasing video and about trust?
It says that there is no trust and that people are always in this environment going to demand to see as much of the video evidence as they possibly can. And the fact that the chief, and I understand his argument there legally speaking, but his legal argument in terms of him not being the custodian, I guess he's saying that may be a private company or a corporate video. My first thought would have been that that's the city's video, the city of Charlotte, because they've got cameras all over uptown that they installed during the Democratic National Convention 4 years ago. So my first thought would have been that would have been some of those cameras, which are the city's. So I'm not sure what he means when he says he's not the custodian.
As soon as he has the video, he is the custodian for the purposes of the public records law, and he can release it if he wants to. However, I think that David's question and about whether or not there's video of the shooting, body camera video, what have you, raises another question that we had in our newsroom as we were out covering the protests. Many of the officers who were doing crowd control and riot response, the bike officers, for instance, weren't wearing body cams that whole week after the shooting of Keith Scott. That's a great question. I don't know. I remember one night we were out walking and I spent, hours with the police on the bicycles who were interacting with these protesters. Specifically, this is after a protester got kind of hit by an ATV, a police officer on an ATV, and the police were looking for video of it. We had some because the officer on the ATV wasn't wearing a body camera. And so if ever there was a time to wear a camera, I would think it would be during the protests and the riots that we had. And that would certainly have answered a lot of questions had there been some video.
Well, as in other cities that have had similar incidents, the police are now examining or re-examining their policies and procedures and trying to rebuild community ties. And Chief Putney told David that this was part of the healing process.
What we saw throughout was raw emotion, anger, and a feeling of disenfranchisement. So what we have to do organizationally is step back and try to connect with people who maybe weren't a part of our conversations before, maybe who haven't really worked with us in the past, and strengthen those, begin to create those opportunities and then strengthen those relationships moving forward.
And Chief Putney also says he has asked the Police Foundation of Washington, D.C. to come in and give the department some feedback on their procedures, because he said the critique of how the department handled things is not his to make. Why not? He's the chief of police.
That was actually in response to a question I asked him about how would you grade yourself so far on handling this. And he said the critique is not mine to make. What CMPD and the city are doing is they're bringing in some outside help to try and zoom the focus back to the big picture here and look at why all this happened the way it did. And, I do think the chief and the city are sincere in wanting to get at the root of this. Why is there no trust? As Eric mentioned a minute ago, there is no trust. It's a much bigger problem than just whether the police released the video fast enough in this one case. It's about systemic problems in Charlotte, and if we want to get philosophical about it.
So the Police Foundation of Washington, D.C., I've never heard of them before, but evidently they're a nonprofit, and this is what they do, is that they come in and look at police departments and offer up suggestions on how to improve policies and procedures?
And they do studies kind of a big picture nature about policing in the U.S. I think their tagline is something like better policing through technology or something like that, innovation and technology. But they also have looked at specific incidents like the California shootings and Ferguson, Missouri. So they've got experience in coming in after crises.
I immediately wondered, though, how does that impact Jennifer Roberts' call for Didn't she call for the Justice Department?
She did, and has asked and has spoken with the Justice Department and requested they do a review. Yeah,
I think the Justice Department review would be a little more specific to whether civil rights were violated in this case,
right.
and maybe a little bit broader.
No, but she's asked for a broader review too. She's asked for two: one of the case and the second of the departments. But the DOJ's kind of taken a hands-off approach, as I understand it.
In cities where incidents like this have occurred, have those police departments and those city governments reacted as quickly with as concrete proposals and hiring certain organizations to come in and look as we have? Are we acting pretty quickly on this is the question, I guess.
You've stumped the panel, Mike.
Yeah. Okay.
I would say that it's 2 weeks out from this shooting, and, Kerr Putney is trying to take a step back and look at the big picture here, which I think is important. Is it faster than other cities? I don't think I can say. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's something that we need to do. And, those protests out there, apart from the small amount of violence, the protests were about voices in the community asking to be heard. And that's really what is the big picture here.
Is that how it will be viewed if we bring in outside interests to look at what happens in CMPD's operations? Is that a way to build trust?
Yeah, I think that's a step, but that's only a step.
Mm-hmm.
I think the city council has talked about some other measures that they're going to take that will be equally as important in terms of trying to address some of these systemic problems that David talked about, how to get income inequality under control, how to get affordable housing in more areas of the community, how to make sure that as Charlotte's, we're a city on the rise economically, but some people are getting left behind. How do we stop that from happening?
Now you sound like Hugh McCall at the city council retreat in Asheville, because that's exactly what he said.
Yeah, and he had a great point. I mean, it was really eye-opening to hear the former chairman of Fortune 500 Bank, one of the biggest banks in the country, just bluntly and flatly say that we have a race problem as well. He said that we have a problem of, how did he put it, bias that takes the form of not caring, or yes, prejudice that takes the form of not caring, I think was his phrase, which was an interesting way to put it. You know, we've got people who are on the margins who are being left behind, and as the rest of Charlotte is barreling forward into this brighter and better tomorrow, we're not caring about these people who are left behind. And as David said, these are voices that are now rising up and saying, hey, what about us? And I think this police shooting and what happened around the Scott case was, it just turned into a vehicle for all these long suppressed and long dormant and unheard grievances and complaints to just come barreling out. And I think the rest of the community was just kind of shocked and taken aback and, mm-hmm, oh my God, we didn't know that all this was there. But it's always been there. And that's what Hugh McCall was saying. We have not succeeded in bringing everybody along for the ride into this New South prosperity that we're going for.
So the Police Foundation of Washington is coming in. How long will their work take? And more importantly, will we be privy to what their suggestions are?
The police department is saying it'll take several months, and there will be a final report. During the several-month process, there'll be meetings with people in the community, including some of those whose voices need to be heard. I think that part of this is not just a final report, but it's a process of bringing people together. And at the end of it, the department says they will be sharing it with the community. I presume that means they'll be releasing it and maybe some meetings around it as well. I think it's needed.
And the chief of police also told you that they were going to be looking into de-escalation and how they train police officers to de-escalate a situation. I don't mean to be critical or Monday morning quarterbacking, but it seems to me that there not only was there no attempt to de-escalate, the only escalation was coming from the police department, and that perhaps part of the problem was they were yelling at Mr. Scott to drop the gun while he was sitting in a vehicle with the windows closed. And to be heard, they had to yell. If they had time to go back and get flak jackets, why didn't they get a bullhorn and speak softly into it and say, please put down the gun? Wouldn't that be a way to de-escalate the situation?
There's a lot of people who say that we have SWAT situations on, biweekly, 3-4 times a week. They call it the SWAT team. Why not? If you were that concerned to go get your gear, why not call the SWAT team and let them handle the situation? So that's definitely one of the criticisms that the department's received.
So this week, City Council sent a letter of support for the police in terms of its operation. Was that letter to the chief? Was it an open letter to the public?
Yeah, it was an open letter to the public.
And everybody on City Council signed it?
No, it was signed just from the City Council.
The City Council, but not the mayor.
Correct.
Which
mayor.
Was
but isn't
interesting.
Isn't she part of the City Council?
She's the mayor. She doesn't have a vote on the City Council. I think if... I interpreted that as not being from Jennifer Roberts.
Yeah. I think we have reported at The Observer that she was not asked to sign it, and she did not sign it.
And members of the City Council said that she's already had her chance to express her feelings on it. So this is the council's turn to share how they see things going to bring the community together.
Should we take that at face value, or is this a political slap on the wrist for the mayor, or is the mayor in political trouble?
I don't know that it's – I guess it's political in the sense that maybe it's backroom City Council politics, but I think it was really two things. One, a frustration from the council members. I mean, because if we've all probably spoken with council members who clearly said that we are frustrated with how the mayor has handled this. But two, I think, two Mondays ago when they sat in that City Council meeting and heard angry, passionate comment after angry, passionate comment from residents of Charlotte, I think it really was eye-opening for some of the members of the council who weren't aware of, the divide that Hugh McCall touched on. Mm-hmm. And I think that really was even for guys like Kenny Smith and Ed Driggs. I mean, they said, wow, thanks for speaking. We appreciate it. And so I think this is their recognition that they must do something, and here was their plan.
Charlotte Chamber, as I've already alluded to, went to Asheville for, I guess it's their annual retreat, where they talk about
every year
city issues. And Mr. McCall, Hugh McCall, former chairman of Bank of America, was one of the speakers. Was he the only speaker? And was he the only speaker to address the recent troubles?
No, Harvey Gantt, I think he was he and Harvey Gantt were on the same panel, I think. Mm-hmm. And Harvey Gantt was echoing a lot of the same things that Hugh McCall was saying. And Harvey Gantt also even said that he was somewhat surprised by what he saw unfolding on TV, and also the fact that some of these people that, you know, were out in the protests and that were driving, you know, this imagery and this discussion, that he did not know them. And so he was sort of saying that Charlotte is not what it used to be, this sort of big, small town where a few people can kind of get together and decide, well, here's what, you know, Charlotte needs to do next, and just among themselves plot the direction.
Which is exactly what used to happen. You had Rolf Neal from The Observer, you had Hugh McCall from Bank of America, Ed Crutchfield from First Union. I think somebody from Jefferson Pilot Broadcasting was involved in that, and a couple of other, Bill Lee from Duke Power, were the seven white guys who ran the city. And they would say, we need something over here, and it would happen. Mm-hmm. We don't have that kind of leadership anymore. The corporations that are now focused here are too big for that. So where are the leaders? Where is the leadership coming from?
I think that's what we got to figure out. That's a big
and
part
would we,
of what we
would
have to
we want
out.
Or accept that kind of top-down leadership today?
No, I think it's pretty clear that we're beyond that point in time. Partially because of the growth of social media and the democratization of media now, where everybody has the bullhorn, everybody can describe, you know, sort of what they feel and sort of get their point across. It's just harder to control the narrative.
You do have certain groups. You have the big four, the Chamber, the CRVA, the Regional Partnership, Charlotte Center City Partners, and they have been coming together for weeks, if not months now, even prior to the shooting, to deal with the HB2 situation and trying to come and show some leadership and move the city past this.
So what was the reaction of the chamber? Because they've had a rough time of it in the last year, and so has Charlotte Center City Partners and the Convention and Visitors Bureau. They've had a tough time of this year. What was their reaction? Anybody know?
I wasn't there.
Okay.
So I can't describe the
You've stumped the panel a second time, Mike.
There was
I do know they're really licking their chops right now. They're kind of almost in the shock phase of dealing with the HB2s type situation and the riots. I've talked to several of the economic development directors who are like, you know, this is going to take us years to recover our image of what we had. Mm-hmm. So they're still in the process of trying to figure out a game plan. I mean, and just look at the hospitality industry. They can't catch a break this year.
Yeah.
I mean, here we have millions of people evacuating from the coast, and all of our hotel rooms are already booked up because of the race. Any other weekend, we had 30,000 hotel rooms to fill.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I'm glad you brought that up. The hospitality industry, there's a letter to the editor this past week in the paper. Perhaps you saw it, Eric. Where a reader was saying,
better.
You know, with all the troubles that the hospitality industry has faced this year because of the cancellation of basketball games, et cetera, due to HB2, the chamber has to go to Asheville to have their meeting. They couldn't have it here and help the people here out. And you know, in the day and age of cell phones, the whole idea of a retreat was to get away from the office and to get away from the calls, right? Yeah. You can't get away from the calls. You can't get away from the emails. They're all on your phone.
Yeah.
You can do that on a conference room on the 35th floor. You know, you don't have to go somewhere else.
Yeah. I will
tell
you.
It's a fair point.
As a person who covered Charlotte City Council for several years, many years back, their retreat where they went out of town, they did their business, the same business they could have done anywhere, but it was the camaraderie that they would do after the hours, the poker games, the cigars that they didn't smoke. And they even have a portion. All right, this is off the record. Everybody, if you've never been to one of these, you have to tell a joke now.
Yeah.
So I think that's where you get that camaraderie and the team building.
All right, we have to take a break. We'll come back with more. That was Sean Flynn, who's managing editor of Time Warner Cable News. Eric Frazier is here, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Nick Oxner from WBTV News, and David Porax from our own news department here at WFAE. The local news roundup continues in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Latin School, committed to helping children become lifelong learners by educating the heart and the mind. Hosting an open house on October 14th for grades 6 to 12. Information at charlottelatin.org. Also, the Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, new location opening soon at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. The weekly news roundup continues on the Diane Rehm Show. The National Hour coming up. Fallout from the only vice presidential debate of the campaign. Congressional Republicans weighing the down-ballot Trump effect. And the FBI arrests another NSA contractor. A panel of journalists joins guest host John Donvan for analysis of the week's top national stories first at 10, the International Hour at 11. And you can join our conversation by going to us Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup.
Adam Stevens, Principal, the British International School of Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
As an international school, one of our core demographics is families that are looking for a broader and deeper interpretation of the world. WFAE's global coverage and the depth of their analysis attracts that kind of discerning listener that we're looking for. The decision to be an underwriter with WFAE was a really easy one. It's just a really good fit.
Email underwriting at WFAE.org for information.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the weekly news roundup. David Borax, Nick Oxner, Sean Flynn, Eric Frazier with us around the table here. We were talking before the break about the Charlotte Chamber's retreat in Asheville. They had some other high-powered executives from the Panthers, the Hornets, the PGA, and Speedway Motorsports participating in a discussion about the impact of HB2. What did they say? Anybody know? Okay.
Oh, just the what they always say, which is that HB2 has just torpedoed. You know, it's the giant, you know, smoking sinkhole in the middle of the room that everybody wants to go
don't
away.
Don't hold back, Eric. Well, I think they're also they've got to be frustrated at this point because the Chamber's tried to really play a mediator here, and there have been multiple times now where we were on the precipice of a deal that just didn't happen. And so I imagine they're probably throwing their hands up at just staring at the sinkhole now instead of trying to call in the dump trucks to fill it in.
Yeah.
I think there is a lot of frustration, and at this point, I think everyone's just waiting for the election to be over. Hopefully, the hate and the anger on national politics goes away. Maybe the same thing on the local level. So I think at this point, we're just in a holding pattern until after November 8th.
Was the governor there at that retreat?
Yes, he was.
Is that where he's told them that we have to find a way, that Charlotte has to find a way to reconnect with the state legislature after years of bruising fights?
That was interesting. Yeah.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't the years of fights begin when the legislature tried to take the airport from the city?
That didn't help. Well, to put it mildly.
I mean, this
seriously, up till HB2, weren't the points of friction coming from the legislature towards Charlotte?
I think that's fair.
Yeah, that's fair.
So why are we being slapped and told that we have to repair our relationship? Why don't they work toward repairing the relationship they should have with the economic engine of the state?
Well, you know what,
I'm going to be a homie here for this question.
What I found interesting about that discussion is that the guy or guys who really drive that point that you're talking about, why is the legislature being so mean to Charlotte, we're not there. That's Senator Berger and Tim Moore. They, I think, more than Tim Moore being the Speaker of the House, those guys, more so than Pat McCrory, I think, animate that discussion from the legislative end. It would have been much more interesting if they were there, but I can't imagine that was probably the last place they wanted to be.
I actually think this stems way, this goes back years. This goes back when Governor McCrory was Mayor McCrory.
Yes.
And he would, and we're talking the great state of Mecklenburg and the rift between, and I can't tell you how many times when he was mayor, he would call out state leaders, and now it's the opposite. And there's just always been that rift between Raleigh and Charlotte.
And he got himself into trouble because he took a busload of constituents when he was mayor to Raleigh and just walked into the legislature unannounced, and that made them very unhappy in Raleigh.
See, and it's all Mayor McCrory's fault. That's why Governor McCrory's upset.
Who's your writer? Who's your comic writer? All right. We are a battleground state, perhaps you've heard. And so the candidates and their surrogates are coming here a lot this election year. Michelle Obama was here campaigning for Hillary Clinton this week, and she tried to remind voters, particularly young voters, of the important role that they played in the election of her husband. Hillary has not lit the same fire under those voters as the president did during his campaigns, given that the First Lady is so well-regarded, could her remarks help light that fire, do you think?
Yeah, they definitely can help. To the extent that they will help, I guess that remains to be seen, and we'll see on Election Day. But Michelle Obama is a very powerful, passionate speaker. I was at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, and I think she, perhaps even more so than her husband, just brought the house down. I mean, she's got it. I think if she were running against Donald Trump right now, she'd be trouncing him by 20 percentage points.
At this time 2 weeks ago, if you looked at any of the electoral maps in the country that they shade red and blue, you would have seen us being slightly pink, meaning not full Republican, but on the edge of going in that direction. And recently, we have become light blue. That happened after the first presidential debate. The second one is on Sunday night. We'll talk about that on this program on Monday morning. But we've turned light blue. Is that a trend, or is that just a blip on the radar because of that debate?
That's probably a trend, and I say that because you also have seen races like Senator Richard Burr, who is running for his third term, should be comfortably in the lead, but is now either tied with his Democratic challenger, Deborah Ross, or behind. I think a new poll has him behind. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a trend that means Democrats are having a surge in North Carolina right now. Now, if that trend will continue through Election Day, I think we'll obviously have to wait and see, but certainly it's good news for Democrats.
Right, and I guess we should mention that blue has traditionally meant Democrat and red has traditionally meant Republican. And the reason I mention that is because Donald Trump keeps wearing a blue tie and Hillary keeps wearing red dresses. I don't understand what they're trying to do. And the same thing happened in the vice presidential debate. Wells Fargo Chairman and CEO John Stumpf spent 2 days over the last several weeks testifying before Congress and enduring withering critiques of his bank and of his handling of a scandal involving the creation of bogus accounts for retail banking customers who did not want them and didn't know they had them. Then, this week, it was revealed that the same thing may have been happening in their brokerage business. How did that news break? And how widespread do we think this is, Eric?
Our banking writer, Dion Roberts, got wind of that from people who he got called and contacted by people who were Wells Fargo, either employees, former employees, and by investors who said that they had had similar problems with investment accounts, If that particular story continues to sort of move forward and grow and mushroom like the retail banking story did, that's a real, real problem.
Well, the retail banking story really emanates out of California because that's where the executives who were in charge of retail banking were. But this story comes out of Charlotte. Mary Mack was in charge of that, right?
Yeah, I believe that's right.
So what if this turns out to be as big as the retail scandal was, what does that mean for John Stumpf's future? And more importantly, what does it mean for Wells Fargo's future and for regulation of banks and banks who have their fingers in investment business as well as retail banking?
Yeah, I think you put your finger on a lot of the implications. All of those questions would come into play. And it would be a much, much larger and more problematic situation for Wells Fargo to corporately to sort of navigate its way through, and more specifically for John Stumpf to navigate his way through and maintain his.
Mike, there's no question that Wells Fargo's reputation has been severely damaged. And it's interesting to me. I covered the banking industry for many years at American Banker, and Wells Fargo on the West Coast, away from Wall Street, was always kind of apart. They were mostly a retail bank, meaning they had checking and savings accounts with people. And so they were not subject to the same criticisms that the East Coast banks were that were heavily involved in investment banking and Wall Street. But that's different now. And, you know, this scandal on the retail bank side is hurt. And the fact that they now are bigger in the investment banking business is hurting them as well. So it'll be interesting to see where this goes.
There seem to be a lot of scandals breaking out recently. Just this week, the Observer did a big thing on lotteries and how there are remarkable number of repeat winners who seem to either work
some
for the
people
places,
are just lucky, as the executive director said.
Who seem to work for the stores that sell these tickets, etc.
They're just lucky.
Well, it took me a couple days to understand it. I kept reading the articles thinking, what's the point here? And the point is what?
Well, the point is that there are some of these people who have won multiple. I think there was one guy who had won like 100 times. And that's just statistically, practically impossible. That just should not ever happen.
What is happening in some cases is that people who are coming back to the store where they bought the ticket are asking the clerk, is this a winning ticket? And the clerk is saying no, keeping the ticket and cashing it in because it is a winning ticket.
Right.
How can people be so stupid?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, the winning numbers are published.
Some people would say even to play the lottery in itself, given the actual odds, is not the smartest.
But the winning
thing you can
numbers
do
are
money.
Published. Why do you have to ask, is this a winning ticket, when clearly the newspaper has that information and so does the lottery website?
Some people just don't want to go through the trouble of,
a lot of people will buy. Forgive me, I felt like a vice presidential debate there. Some people buy.
Let me interrupt you.
Some of the lottery people, will buy $100 worth of tickets, and you have 100 different numbers, and you're not going to go through and look at every single one of them. I know I do.
How's that working out for you?
Yeah. So I've played twice in how many years?
Now, there's also a VA scandal that you've been looking into. We looked into it, and Channel 3 looked into it as well. The Veterans Administration, as we all know, had a terrible track record of unacceptable waiting times for patients, some of whom actually died while waiting to see a doctor. And we're talking about over a period of months and years getting in to see a doctor. And so that was all supposed to have been fixed. And then this week, WFAE and WBTV are looking into this in the Salisbury VA, and evidently it hasn't been fixed, and yet the VA there is saying, no, that's old news. It's from several years ago, and it has been fixed. What's the story?
Yes, well, and if you believe the director—
And Time Warner Cable has also reported on this. I'm sorry.
Spectrum.
Thanks, Mike.
Spectrum, yes.
If you believe the message that the director of the Salisbury VA had yesterday, yes, they say that this has all been fixed now. However, that's exactly what she said when this investigation began by investigators with the Office of the Inspector General. Started an inquiry based on an anonymous tip in April of 2014. That investigation lasted through March of 2015. And what the investigation found is that employees were directed by some supervisors to manipulate, to fluff numbers. That's the direct quote from the investigation. To fluff numbers or manipulate numbers that it looked as though veterans were only waiting 14 days or less for an appointment. And that's important because at the time, that is the metric by which the director, her boss, and some of the other midline supervisors were being evaluated on. And so that 14-day wait time is very important, and it was being manipulated at the Salisbury VA, including one department, the Women's Health Clinic at the Salisbury VA, that had a secret list of people who were waiting for appointments that stretched 500 days. Some people had to wait, according to what the investigation found.
This is after it was all supposedly fixed several years ago.
Correct. I mean, the first round of things came out, this started in April 14th, so that would be after the first revelations about these wait times. And that's why I believe it is significant. And so at the time, the director of the Salisbury VA told investigators, and she reiterated this in her press release, and I said it at the press conference yesterday, that they had already proactively been auditing wait times, and they had taken their own action as early as 2013, and yet she said they hadn't found anything when investigators with the IG's office spent some time and looked and found exactly, some wrongdoing. And so I asked her about that yesterday. I said, well, what were you looking at that they weren't looking at as far back as 2013? And she admitted that they actually hadn't started their audits until mid-2014 because their software wasn't correct.
There's another element. There's a second report in which they talked about a big backlog of radiology and x-ray reports. And I think it was more than 3,000. And these are people that were waiting to get these appointments to have an x-ray, for example. And they stretched on forever, and in this report, it talks about 15 patients who died while waiting to get these. Now, the VA's response was, and the Inspector General's response was, they looked into it, and they can't say that any of those 15 died because they didn't get an appointment. But it reflects the problem that we've seen in other locations as well.
They also said in that news conference that the supervisors who were responsible for the training of those schedulers are either no longer with the firm or are no longer in a supervisorial role. And they added at the end, they said no one's been fired yet, but that doesn't mean no one will be fired. So there is still more chapters to be written in this saga.
And speaking of more chapters to be written in the in sagas, the Coal Ash saga continues. We heard a lot in over the summer about, is it Ken Rudow, who was the scientist who testified that the state was a little too premature in issuing the water is safe to drink around these coal ash ponds, and he kind of took the bullet, and evidently the guy who testified against him, Thomas Stiff, the governor's chief of staff, now says he didn't read the report before he testified against Mr. Rudow. Is that essentially it?
Well, he didn't test. Well, he has ultimately now given testimony that contradicts Ken Rudow's claims. But he issued a press release on behalf of the governor. That's the governor's chief of staff. Issued a press release and held a late night press conference where he accused Ken Rudow of lying under oath, which is a pretty substantial claim. And so this week, in a deposition of Mr. Stith that was released this week, he admits to an attorney that he didn't read the deposition transcript before he accused him of lying under oath, which is just another interesting chapter in the Coal Ash saga that will go on and has other interesting chapters just this week.
And, you know, there's a little more to this as well. This came out because of a motion in a lawsuit that's trying to compel Thomas Stith to answer other questions that he did not answer in that deposition. And so, and that has to do with this meeting that supposedly happened between Rudow and the governor's press secretary and maybe the governor on the telephone. And so there are still questions being asked about that as well.
Mm. I want to, because it's a Friday and I want to end this program on an up note, let's talk about the Panthers. Derek Anderson is likely.
Yeah, dude.
That's cold.
Derek
That's
Anderson cold. Is likely to start as quarterback because Cam is probably going to be out right for with a concussion.
It looks that way.
And that
yeah.
will change the speed of play because he's much quicker in the pocket. That's not like I know what I'm talking
wow.
about. Much
we
quicker.
Bring you on sports night.
This is the most sports talk public radio's heard. And
anyway, he's quicker in the pocket because he what? I knew this for a nanosecond.
He was, 16 of 19 last week when he came in after yeah, Cam got hurt?
Derek,
does it matter?
Derek Anderson is one of the best backup quarterbacks. And he's already beaten the Bucks twice in the last three
I have
years.
A theory why we're 1-3.
Oh, because boy.
Cam is not doing the dab anymore.
Oh, that's gone.
They did it on Mike. They did it three times last night on Atlanta. David Borax, Nick Oxner, Sean Flynn, Eric Frazier, all of our reporters around the roundtable, which will continue on the Diane Rehm Show